You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Harrison Hill. Harrison Hill grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, and now lives in Brooklyn, New York. He received his MFA in nonfiction from Columbia University, where he also taught undergraduate writing. His journalism and essays have appeared in The Cut, GQ, Vogue, Travel and Leisure, The Guardian, and The Threepenny Review. The Oracle's Daughter is his first book. It is a gripping chronicle of the rise and fall of a woman-led cult and the enduring allure of extremism across America's turbulent religious history. As dramatic as it is deeply researched, The Oracle's Daughter also traces the long, strange history of American religious life, illuminating the porous boundary between the fringe and the mainstream, showing how much more vulnerable we are to extremism than we might like to believe. Here is Harrison Hill. It is so nice to be able to speak with Harrison Hill today, the author of The Oracle's Daughter, among many other things that you do and that we'll find out about. But it is exciting to be able to hear about a group that we haven't covered yet on the show. And as I've done a little bit of research into it, there's so much crossover for me in terms of other cultic groups and how they operate, and also how they devolve and go into the dark side. and why that happens. But let's get started with you spending a moment introducing yourself. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Rachel. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thrilled to have this conversation. By way of an introduction, I'm a writer based in New York City. I grew up in Virginia, Charlottesville, Virginia. This is my first book, The Oracle's Daughter. It'll come out on April 7th. It's been a really remarkable experience, fascinating in terms of the intensity of the material, fascinating creatively. Yeah, lots to talk about, both in terms of how I came to this story, what the group is, and how it all worked. It's funny, though, you mentioned at the beginning, you said this was a group you hadn't heard of. And that's very often something that people will say to me. And I sort of have this wonderful moment because I'm like, yeah, do I have a book for you? So yeah, this group was called the Aggressive Christianity Missions Training Corps, and it really hasn't received much coverage other than, frankly, a piece that I wrote for The Cut a number of years ago that is the basis for this book. They've largely been under the radar, except for local media in and around Albuquerque in New Mexico, where they were once based.
Right. And like a lot of other groups, I wish I could say I'm proud of how prolific California has been in creating weird things. But yes, I know it got its start. When you hear about a group and then you read these stories, and I was reading the story about this Christian radio station that was refusing to broadcast the Greens content, the leaders' content, and went on to say, the content about demons promoting homosexuality, karate, and fairy tales. You're like, you know what? There's a lot to talk about here.
Right.
I'm sorry,
right.
What? Even though I don't do I'm sorry, what very often because I'm used to hearing these sorts of things, but every once in a while something, just the whole sequence of words does take me by surprise. So let's start actually by me asking you about your interest in this kind of story and what brought you into really wanting to get into it, and not just about this group, but sort of expanding, looking at this big picture also, which I loved. So tell me about what drew you.
Before I get into that, I think it's probably useful for me to give a little bit of an overview of what the book is, as you were mentioning. You know, it is both the story of a woman who escaped this group that was run by her mother, and the story of the group more generally, how it was founded, as you said, in California, fled to New Mexico, ultimately came down because of a really wild legal battle that ended up in court. But it's also the story of American extremism in the religious history of the country. It was really important to me that the book wasn't just sort of like an isolated story just about this one group, this one woman. It was important to me to kind of situate it in a broader context and also, you know, dig into those fascinating questions that we're all so intrigued by about, like, why do people join these groups? What is it that's appealing to them? Why do they stay? How do they leave? All those kind of things. My hope for the book is that it combines all of those things, both a very kind of intimate examination of these people in this group and the broader questions at play. You asked me about what drew me to this story. It's really interesting. I do not have a background of deeply following all the documentaries and the podcasts and everything like that. I came to it a little bit of an outsider, which I've tried to use as something that's sort of creatively useful, because I would love for my readers to be both people who are really interested in this kind of material and people who are also new to it, so that it can be a primer for those folks while also satisfying those who are more knowledgeable. The way that I initially came to the story, in 2019, my younger brother, who used to live here in Brooklyn, where I live now, a pipe burst in his apartment, and he frantically was like running around the building and ran across the hallway to try and like turn off the pipe or whatever. There was a woman who was walking out of her apartment right across the hallway, and she saw him running around and she was like, can I help you? And he said, yes, pipe burst. That would be great if you could help me. She went over, she helped him fix the situation. And then after that, they slowly became friendly. And eventually she revealed her name was Sarah Green, and she had escaped a cult run by her mother years earlier. They gradually got to know each other over the weeks and months that followed. And eventually my brother said, my brother's a writer. He might want to write about you. Could I introduce you guys? Happily for me, she said yes. That was sort of the wild bit of happenstance that led to the writing of the book. I should say also, though, my interests, the sort of like core thematic and narrative interests for me with this book really come down to, I mean, this sounds so big, but I really want the book to be about this. It's like my interest is in the human condition. And I think that cults provide this kind of petri dish of seeing the elements of what it is to be a human being seeing those at their most intense. And by seeing them at their most intense, there's a way for us to see them in our own lives, whose our lives are hopefully not quite so intense. But there's a way that it's like the exaggerated version is a way of shining light on the non-exaggerated version. I think also what drew me to the story purely creatively was that, goodness gracious, is it a good story? I didn't have anything to do with that. It just felt like this perfect narrative item that had a really fascinating beginning, which is these hippies become Christians, then they become cultists, then they have children, they found this cult, they get in a lot of trouble, and then they get in a lot of legal trouble, and there's a trial, and then everything comes crashing down. There's like a very elegant rise and fall action, which for me as a writer, I'm like, oh, I gotta explore that. There's just like a deep satisfaction of feeling yourself like hitch into the, like the little car on the roller coaster. And you're like, you know, I got to do the work. I got to do the research. And it is a ton of work and writing. And it's very challenging, but also like you kind of want to just give into it and let it take you where it takes you. So yeah, those are the different ways that I got into it.
I like it. Yes. I'm in the midst of writing a book now, and authors love arcs. We do. We just love them, right?
Always, always. And cults, it's interesting. I do think cults lend themselves to arcs because there's always this inciting incident. Why did someone found this group? Why did someone join it? And then often these groups come crashing down. And so right there you have starting action, conflict, collapse, and hopefully a happy ending, but more often than not, like a real ending, which is to say an ending that has both good and bad interwoven between them, which is certainly the case for this story.
I'm sure, right. I mean, people can really get free from something but be so scarred, and the scars are invisible. And so you just don't know how deep they are, how long they've lasted, and how long they will last. I think it's really lovely that this all started from this woman wanting to help your brother. I mean, that's just a lovely start to this.
Totally.
Happenstance, but also so nice. I grew up in LA, then lived in Boston, then lived in New York, actually in Park Slope before it was as gentrified as it is now. Then came back to LA. But something that I do remember from being in New York was that people often offered help, sometimes whether you wanted it or not.
Right.
But I remember there was one time I was just had my first kid and he's in a stroller and I'm at the bottom of these stairs in the subway and it was hot and there was no air conditioning, of course. There's just a ton of stairs and I needed to somehow carry, oh, and there was no elevator or it was broken.
Of course.
This person who I did not know, some guy, just swooped up and picked up my stroller with my baby in it, went running up the stairs and I thought, he's stealing my baby.
Oh my God.
Go to yell and he puts it down at the top and he says, I'll wait. And I said, oh my goodness, he's just helping. I was not used to that. So it is a nice thing and a lovely thing sometimes in different places where people just reach out and they say, what can I do? But also that I don't know this woman, Sarah, but that she would have every reason to not be that person.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. That is the miracle of the story in many ways.
Yeah, right? Because it can make you angry and it can make you reclusive and it can make you not trusting. It can make you feel like you don't want to be self-sacrificial anymore in this world. And here, her nature, when I talk to so many people who have come out of cultic groups, they say they were able to meet themselves for the first time. They were able to see who they really were when they weren't reacting to the situation they were in, when they weren't being told how to be or told to be cold or told to be something that's really against their nature, their conscience. And this is who she is. It's beautiful.
That's so well said and interesting. I love this idea of you leave this group and then you actually meet this other person who is in fact yourself. I don't want to speak for Sarah because she would phrase things her own way. But if I were to summarize what I think her experience is, it was really hard for her in those initial years after getting out of the group, which I guess we haven't said the name of the group. It has this wild name. It was called the Aggressive Christianity Missions Training Corps. A very, very, very intense group.
Yeah, which we'll talk about. And I love
how
raw the name is, how obvious they make it that it's militaristic and aggressive, because usually that's hidden. But they're like, nope, This is how we're going to behave.
Yeah.
So yes, we will come back to that, but go finish your point.
Right. The years following her escape from this group, they were tough. She was about as strong and resilient and tough as a person could possibly be given these circumstances. I mean, most of her life, she'd grown up in this group. She'd been around these really destructive teachings, and yet she still had this like vision of this life she wanted for herself. There were some very specific things she wanted. She wanted an education. She wanted to find a way to get her kids out. When she left the group, she left her kids. She wanted to go to midwifery school. She was so fascinated by things, issues around childbirth and wanting to help women, and just really loved everything around childbirth. And so she was like, I'm going to leave. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to begin again. And of course, reality is more complicated than that. It didn't come true exactly in the way that she'd hoped. And yet at the same time, I do think it probably is true. I mean, she probably would say a version of what you said before. Leaving the group was a way for her to meet her authentic self. And I think maybe it would be like her authentic self was with her when she was in the group, but it was buried. It was a kind of act of excavation rather than just pure introduction.
Yeah, I think that's lovely. And sometimes people, they can't explore the softer sides of themselves. They have to be tough. They have to endure. They have to be willing to fight the fight or God's fight or whatever it is that you're taught that you're engaged in. But just to be kind, just to take your time with things, just to slow life down, notice that someone else needs help. That's not something that people have the liberty actually to have. You're supposed to be just so directed on the mission and to mimic how the leaders are behaving as the ideal way to behave.
That's so interesting, like that it's difficult to access softness and sensitivity. And I was just thinking to myself as you were saying that, I was like, how did Sarah access that? She might say something different, but my observation of what she's told me is that she's a very personable person. And so I think it's like the other people in her life, people she met, people who were able to meet her in a really normal and non-abusive and really supportive way. I think that was essential. I also think Sarah's somebody who just loves the kind of tactile things of the world. She loves plants. She loves rocks. She loves going on walks. She's a huge runner. She loves to run around the city and see things and take pictures. And she's really interested in kind of the sensual experience of the world. And I don't mean sexual. I mean sensual in all five senses, really being there. And I think that being in a cult is about the restriction of those five senses. You don't have access to the kind of full range of the human experience. And leaving the cult that Sarah was in was a way of being in touch, literally being in touch with the world. And I think that that was a way of softening, of finding a deeper humanity. One's deeper humanity is a soft, sensitive thing. Well, part of it is at least. And so I think that that was all, yeah, a little bit of a piece.
That's really beautiful. I mean, yes, I know we're talking about her and kind of for her a little bit.
I know, yeah.
Apologize. Sorry, Sarah. And if she ever wants to come on to tell her story, I'd love to. This is an open invitation to Sarah or to both of you to come on together to talk.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That would be lovely. I think there was a mentor of mine who since passed, unfortunately, Dr. Margaret Singer, who was at Berkeley.
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly know her. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. She was fantastic. And one of the quotes of hers, and I think at this point I've said it so often, I might actually be paraphrasing, but basically the idea is when you're in a, well, I call them systems of control. She didn't say that when you're in kind of a cultic system, when you were talking about the senses, she said you learn to deny the evidence of your senses, as well as not being able to access your senses. So you're seeing things, but you're not supposed to see that or believe it as such, or not trust how you see it, how you interpret it. You feel things, but that's wrong to feel it. If it's negative, you have to ignore it, whether it's hunger or tiredness or anger, resentment, all the just deny, 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 ignore, ignore. Then it's very hard to come to when you come out to say, oh, wait, I get to actually see things and I have to learn to trust that what I'm seeing is accurate so that then I can act accordingly. I'll know like, right. Oh, that's danger. I was used to have to ignore that. It's an interesting and very difficult journey, actually.
Yeah. what I was just thinking about there was when someone's in one of these groups and they see something that conflicts with their interior sense of what's true, there's this really perverse way where that itself can become evidence of the group's correctness, because there's this narrative that the leaders will often have, which is that that is Satan or the devil tempting you. So there's a way that it can slot into the narrative that even that suits the leader's purposes. Even if you're like, oh, it doesn't seem right that I'm supposed to beat my children or whatever, the leader can then say, see, that is Satan telling you this. This is proof of the fact that, in fact, I am telling you the right thing. And there's something so chilling about that, because how are you supposed to break out of that container? I mean, it's very hard. We all know.
Right, right. Incredible. I'm curious also about the militaristic part of this. So if you can introduce us to the leaders, so to speak, and what made them tick.
The group at the center of this book, it began in the early 1980s. And initially, it was called Free Love Ministries. It's a kind of strange name for a group that ends up being what it ultimately was. But the people who founded the group, this couple named Jim and Deborah Green, they'd been hippies prior to their lives as extremist pseudo-Christians, as I call them. And so they were familiar with the counterculture, with all the lingo, with all the vibes and all that kind of stuff. I think they brought that to the founding of the group. They also were really literal about it. They were like, well, God's love is free, so we'll call it Free Love Ministries. And then also, they were like, this will drive away conventional Christians who are put off by hippie-ish things. I mean, there's so many levels to that, it's kind of hard to follow. But it's this very convoluted backwards logic that would itself direct a lot of the ways that they behaved. Anyways, all that to say, as the group began and started building and growing and recruiting new members, it started adopting more explicitly militaristic or paramilitary kind of elements. From the beginning, the couple at the top of the group, Jim and Deborah, they had insisted that there was a big spiritual war was going on, and that this group was this group of elite believers who was going to lead the way. They called themselves God's army sometimes. They were going to lead the way in fighting Satan and bringing about the purification of the world, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, really similar lingo and ideology to a lot of similar groups like that. But as the years went by, they eventually took a new name. The name they took was called the Aggressive Christianity Missions Training Corps. It's such a wild name. Whenever I say it to people, their eyes start lighting up on the second or third word, and then they just grow. And I'm like, the word is still going. So that was one of their names. They had a lot of other names. They called themselves the Shimra Na Holy Nation, God's Royal Regiment. I mean, there were a lot of names, but the Aggressive Christianity Missions Training Corps was the main one. And for them, the military component of the group, it all came down to this idea that they were engaged in an act of spiritual warfare, and that this was not some sort of metaphorical thing. It wasn't like, we're fighting evil in the world. It was like, no, they're literally demons out in the world doing these things that we are called to fight. And so as part of that, they got military uniforms. They took military titles. The couple at the top of the group, they became known as generals, Jim and Deborah Green. The children were privates. There were like pinning ceremonies where people would be called to the front of the room when the group was in Sacramento and given these pins to be like, you know, you've been promoted, you're a corporal, you're a first lieutenant, what have you. And so the military stuff was really at the center of it. And it aligned with that idea of this group really being into what they called aggressive Christianity. There's a really interesting history behind that term. There was a book from the late 19th century called Aggressive Christianity that was written by a woman named Catherine Booth. I'm pretty sure that's her name. I hope I'm not getting it wrong. But this woman, Catherine Booth, wrote this book that was also a speech called Aggressive Christianity. She basically was advocating for a version of Christianity that was not so much based in a kind of love and outreach and that kind of thing that is you might more commonly associate with Christianity. It was obviously much more aggressive. But what's interesting to me is that she and her husband were the couple who founded the Salvation Army, which we know today is the used item store and people who often are ringing bells and stuff, raising money outside of stores around Christmas time. And I don't say that to malign the Salvation Army at all. I mean, they do plenty of really great work. But it is interesting to think about where that came from. I mean, they're called the Salvation Army. I mean, I certainly didn't think about it. It's like, ideologically, at the beginning, there was a similar intensity there.
Wow. I just want to say I was, what do they say, like today, days old when I found out.
Exactly.
It has never occurred to me.
Me neither.
It's weird that it's called an army and that it has kind of a militaristic bent. And it just shows how much you can get desensitized to certain language and not understand where it came from and not even question it.
And there's not something necessarily malicious about that. It's like
No.
We become accustomed to the things that we see. And I just do want to really make clear that I'm talking about the early years of the Salvation Army, and that's effectively a completely different organization there. Now, it was in the soil of its early growth. But yeah, the military stuff, it continued for years. And yeah, it was just really central to the group's idea of itself.
Yeah, to talk more about the militaristic part, because I think there are a lot of people who will talk about things being a battle. And the expression that there's nothing as unifying as a common enemy. If you have this idea that you have to band together because there's an enemy outside, you really do feel like you're in the trenches together, you're fighting this holy war. People will also say to me, even if I wasn't in a group that was militaristic, I was taught to be myself, that I had to save people. And if I didn't, I was going to hell. There was a lot at stake. And I didn't mind then getting into people's faces, and I didn't mind telling them they were going to hell. I mean, I thought I was doing the right thing, and people will say, I now want to apologize to everyone who I accosted thinking I was saving them when I was sure just sort of alarming them thinking there's something wrong with me. But I really felt righteous. I felt entitled, but I felt like I had to do this for them.
Totally, totally. Yeah, so much there. I mean, I think about how that kind of binary thinking, us versus them, that is intrinsic to the question of a battle because you have two sides to a battle, that is just a deeply attractive way of thinking for our species. Like, our life is so complicated and muddled and gray, and there's just a mixture of things. And sometimes you just want someone to be like, no, this is how it is. And cults or cultic groups offer that. And military stuff really helps. It's exciting. It's galvanizing. It's clarifying to know, like, okay, I'm on this side. And then there are people on that side. And yeah, it just speaks to the sort of most basic needs and anxieties that we have. It's tough to just wonder and not be sure. And we want to be sure about things. And a militaristic line of thinking can help make you feel sure about something.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. It's so black and white, which I know is also hard to leave. To enter the world of gray, which is often panic-inducing.
It's difficult, not just emotionally or spiritually, but it's also literally difficult. I would hear these accounts of former members of the group, ACMTC. I would hear them talk about how they would leave, and then they would go to the grocery store, and they'd be like, I don't know what to buy. There's so many kinds of pasta. Which one? Macaroni? Angel hair? Like, I don't know. I didn't have to make that decision. And maybe sound sort of crazy to be like, there's complexity going on there, but there is. You have to make a choice. And I mean, who among us has also not gone to the grocery store and been like, I don't know, what am I going to buy? This is a much more extreme version of that, of course. But cults, they relieve you of the burden of having to make a call like that. And that is just deeply attractive to people.
Oh, it's deeply attractive. And people will say that part of the reason that here they had been at whatever, Berkeley, and got involved in a cult and are now standing in front of their washing machine, not really knowing what button to push and who
should
call.
I mean, but don't we all not know which button to push it on?
Oh, God,
right? I'm kidding.
No, but it's true.
My washing machine, certainly.
Oh, because I never read manuals, so I have to figure it out.
No. I know what you're saying, though. These little things that shouldn't feel catastrophic decisions become decisions, and they're exhausting because of
that. They're exhausting. And I think catastrophic actually is interesting because it's not, I mean, for some situations, I'm sure you're taught that something catastrophic can happen, but it's the idea of making a mistake that you're going to be held to a certain standard of perfection, or you're just going to be wrong all the time and be reminded how you were wrong all the time because you made a decision on your own. Then you're demoted or you're publicly shamed for it. Like the consequences were so great that I think that also leaves people not knowing what pasta to buy.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, goodness knows, you don't want to like choose spaghetti and then end up in hell. I'm speaking in jest, but these groups, they dictate behavior down to the smallest thing, and that includes what you eat. And Yeah, you're right. I mean, it becomes just soul rattling to wonder, like, which one should I do?
I think that's also the title of your next book, Picking the Wrong Spaghetti and Winding Up in Hell.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. So I'm curious just about what you know about Sarah and growing up in this kind of situation.
The book, as I mentioned earlier, it's the story of this group, the rise and fall of this group. It's about cults and all those kinds of groups more generally. It's about American religious history. But at the center of the book, at the center of the story, is this woman named Sarah Green. She's on the cover of the book right here. As you can see, that's like a really striking photograph of her, really close on her face. And she is the daughter, the titular Oracle's daughter. And so she's the reader's way of moving through the events in the book. She was born in the early 70s. She grew up in this group. She had a little bit of time before her parents became super extreme, where she became slightly acquainted with the real world, which I think was essential in her ability to get out. But all through growing up, she had ambitions of something different. She ran away from home when she was a teenager. She tried to enroll herself in school. She just desperately wanted to be in school and have friends. She had dreams of being a midwife, as I mentioned earlier. She just wanted to run around and ride her bike, a very outdoorsy, funny, charming person who had a real zest for life and just wanted the things that we all want and was really keenly aware of how she didn't have access to them. As she grew older, she became more and more depressed, frankly, and despairing, and had to sort of, on some level, at some point, she was just like, it seems impossible, like I'm ever gonna get out of this situation. But then when she was in her mid-20s, after having had a couple children, she, in the middle of the night, managed to get up out of her sleeping bag, tiptoe out of the house, walk through the orchards of this super remote compound in New Mexico, because by this point, the cult had fled to New Mexico. She quietly sneaks away with a backpack with just $200 cash, a granola bar, some water. She's joined by one other person who's leaving with her, and just heads west. I mean, it's this thing that, like, you certainly hope you would have the same amount of courage to do so, but I don't know that I have that much faith in myself. She managed to leave the group and then made her way up to Seattle and knew no one there. That's a phrase we kind of throw around, like, oh, I moved to New York and I knew no one there. But this is for real. She really knew no one there and was no one to anybody, which is part of what all makes it so remarkable to me. She wasn't leaving this cult and then meeting up with her family. Her family was the cult. There was nothing for her out there. She'd read that there were some midwifery schools in Seattle, and so that was why she ended up there. She was able to create a version of the life she'd wanted to create, and some things she didn't get and some things she did. I think there have been a lot of little things that helped her start over. You know, she's a huge runner. Running marathons is the thing she does. I really do think that's the way she processes and handles the trauma, which of course is still with her. But she's a remarkable person. You know, I mean, one of the real pleasures of writing and journalism is that you meet these people. There's no reason you would ever meet them or get to know them in real life. And there's this profound intimacy that comes with it that's sort of unlike any other kind of intimacy in a person's life, at least in my experience. I mean, of course, the deepest intimacies are with you a person has in their life or with their loved ones or friends and family and everything. There's like a very specific kind of intimacy that you get with an authorial relationship where we started speaking in 2019. That was when I had my first interview with her. I just met her in a bar in Brooklyn and just got beers. And I was like, tell me about yourself. And from there began this remarkable, long, long, deep, interesting relationship. And we would speak every couple weeks, every month or two when I was first reporting the article that began the beginning of this book. And then when I sold the proposal for the book and began writing it in earnest, we set up a weekly Thursday afternoon chat where I would walk over to her apartment. We'd chit-chat a little bit. She'd give me some granola that she'd made. She's a great cook. And we'd just get back into it. Just say, you know, last week we got up to here. What happened next? And how did that make you feel? You know, those, as I've always heard, are like the two key questions of journalism. What happened next and how did that make you feel? It took years. So now it's 2026. I finished writing the book last year in 2025. It's this long, deep, and really meaningful relationship. It's sort of like a friendship meets a therapeutic relationship, meets a pure, I don't know, outsider objective journalistic relationship. I mean, like, the book is objective on her experiences. I don't want to suggest otherwise. And at the same time, there's a real richness to the relationship, the journalistic connection that any writer has with sources that they've worked with for a very long time.
Right. I mean, it sounds very special. And I'm assuming she looked forward to these Thursday meetings to continue telling her story.
I hope she did.
I mean, I think you gave her this impression that is correct, I think, if I can make it, well, I'm showing my bias. I think you want to honor someone's story and you want to give it the importance that it has, because a lot of people will put that whole life behind them and they'll know that no one will understand it anyway, or they might judge it, or they might look at them kind of askew after that and think there's something wrong with them. So that you got to have her be able to say all the things and really give them credence and importance, the importance that they deserved.
I mean, it's an honor and frankly, like a tremendous responsibility, and one that I do not take lightly whatsoever. There was a point at which she said to me, she was like, you know me better, or you know more about me than anyone else in the world. You want to carry that carefully. That's a tremendous amount of trust. I want to honor that.
It is really an incredible thing. And part of the reason that I do this podcast and I do this work is because each person's story is fascinating. Each person's story shows what we are vulnerable to and what we're searching for just as human beings. And sometimes people will say, what kind of person gets involved in a cult? And I'll say the kind of person who's a person.
Oh, I love that.
Who is human and who is searching. And sometimes it's a who question, sometimes it's a when question. They're looking for something then. And so let's appreciate that, acknowledge that, and now let's move the spotlight back. If there's going to be any kind of judgment, blame, diagnoses, let's move it back to the people who did this to them, who deceived them, who caught them up in something. But there's nothing wrong with them. They're just human. So let's look at human beings. Let's look at what we learn from learning about these stories.
Absolutely. I mean, I could not agree more. And I think that that's thematically central to my book. At least I hope it is. The epigraph for the book, that little quote that often is at the very beginning of a book, is a quote from the religious philosopher William James. I have to recommend him to your listeners. He has a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience, which I'm sure many of you and everyone has read. But if you haven't, it's just the most thoughtful and powerful book about, as the title says, the varieties of religious experience. The quote that I use from that book, that is the epigraph of the book, is, "The sanest and best of us are of one clay with lunatics and prison inmates." I'll just say that again, because you kind of have to follow it. "The sanest and best of us are of one clay with lunatics and prison inmates." I mean, what he's saying is that we're all made out of the same stuff. And for people who sort of insist otherwise, there's just a real naivete or kind of a lack of wisdom going on there. That really is at the center of the argument of the book, which is that there is this shared humanity among people who are not in cultic groups, people who are, and for that matter, the people who run cultic groups. I mean, it was important to me that the book, while really holding specifically Deborah Green, the leader of the cult, while holding her to account, I really did want to find the humanity in her. Like I said, we're of one clay with lunatics and prison inmates, which she was a prison inmate, at least for a time. And it's up to people to decide whether or not they want to think she's a lunatic, but we all have the same machinery. And my hope is that readers will both appreciate and be struck by the extremity of the things that happen in this book. Really be, I mean, it is honestly shocking, but at the same time, that feeling underneath where you're like, oh, but I see how someone was like, you know what? Why not? Why not go by for a meeting or two? Okay, why not stay for the weekend? Well, they're making dinner. I don't really want to cook dinner. What if I go there for dinners? Oh, and they gave me some clothes. Why not? They're great clothes. Da, da, da. I don't have to buy them. Oh, I have a job. It's all these little steps along the gradient of extremism that you look up one day and then you're running around slashing the air with invisible demon slaying swords and committing crimes and trying to kidnap people from Mexico. I mean, it's all on the same continuum, which I think should trigger both compassion and empathy and understanding on our part, and also a certain amount of, like, I don't know, watchfulness, or not fear, but like I don't know, like awareness of self. What are people, I mean, I don't want to suggest everyone's like surrounded by people who are trying to pull them into cults, but what are the things, how are we shaped by culture in ways that perhaps we don't want to be shaped by culture? How are we responding to things in ways that are not really in keeping with our fundamental values, but maybe that are kind of socially easy to do?
I love that. Right. I think sometimes people will ask me how they know that they're getting involved in something either healthy or unhealthy, or even a relationship that's healthy or unhealthy. And part of what I focus on is deception. You can take on an idea, you can think, okay, let me try it on for size, or even get involved with a new person in your life. But if they have an agenda that they haven't informed you of, then you are going into quicksand without realizing that you're going into quicksand. And you are, in a very open way, wanting to invite something new or learn or change. And whatever they're promising you is not really what they are intending. And that's on them, because that's the well-oiled machine of their manipulation. But I think searching, being open, all of these are really great traits, actually.
Right. Who doesn't want to be open to the world? I certainly do. I want to be searching. I mean, I think that that's what we do. And again, as you said earlier, it's very much just a question of when. Are you at a transition moment in your life? If you are, then you're more vulnerable to these kind of things. I also want to mention, the book is really the story of three women. It's the story of Sarah, it's the story of her mother, Deborah, and it's also the story of a third woman named Maura Schmier, another remarkable woman who was one of the very first members of the group. She really embodied this sense of searching and hunger for truth. Part one of the book is called Signs and Wonders. And that was the phrasing she used with me, was that when she was younger, when she was, you know, a young woman wearing patchouli and beads and things like that, she was looking for signs and wonders. And there's something tremendously beautiful and moving to me about that. In her case, it led her to some really, really dark places. She was horrifically mistreated in this group. And at the same time, in the years I spent speaking with her, I just was over and over again so just struck by that warm and searching spirit, which, of course, okay, it led her into a really dark part of society. It also just makes her just an incredibly generous and kind and thoughtful person. This is life. It's the whole bag. It's the good and the bad. And obviously, she would prefer not to have had these terrible experiences. But as an outsider of hearing about her own experiences, I also just want to say she has a kind of openness that I think we all should want.
Mm-hmm. Part of the thing that's not going to sound like professional term, but part of the thing that really pisses me off is that people take advantage of that. They'll say, oh, good, I'm glad people are open. Now let me offer them poison without telling them that it's poison.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a horrible thing. But also, it's also true that groups will sometimes start out certain ways and transform over time and become more militaristic, become more poisonous. It depends where the leaders go, sometimes psychiatrically. Or they get filled up with their own power.
For sure, yeah.
I want to hear actually more about the women. I want to hear about their lives, where they crossed over, you know, in these ways.
The three women at the center of the book. It's an incredible, and I'll just tell the tidbits of it because I think that there's much more that can be found in the book that I hope people will be interested to check out. The book begins with Maura, the woman who I was mentioning earlier. She was in her early 20s working as a nurse's aide in Sacramento in the late 1960s and early 1970s. She was trying to find meaning in her life. And at the time, that meant working in a medical environment. She felt like it was, as she described it to me, the trenches of life, where you're encountering things at their most real and potent and intense. So she was working there. And then one day she was walking down the hallway and she looked down and there was a man chained to a gurney at the end of the hallway. And she was like, well, that's intriguing and interesting. He was young. He was handsome. He had a kind of mysterious look about him. Maura then goes into the nurse's station, pulls out his chart, looks up who he is. Turns out he's a young man in his early 20s, right around her age, who has robbed a burger joint and so had run into some trouble with the law, but he'd also he'd come down with cancer. And so he was taken to the hospital to be treated. Maura became his nurse or one of his nurses and helped care for him in the months that followed. In the course of that, the man's sister. At the time, she was named Lila, but she would become Deborah, this leader of the cult. The man's sister came and visited him because her younger brother was sick and she wanted to be there with him. In the course of those months, Mora became friendly with her and the young man. And when the young man died, the two women were effectively best friends. It's a kind of crucible of the intensity of the experience of the young man's death was such that they had this remarkable bond. They were also bonded by a kind of hunger for life, wanting to see the world, wanting to experience things, to do things remarkable. They became very close friends. The friendship splintered shortly thereafter for reasons that I get into in the book. But then as the years went by, they eventually reconnected. And as a result of that, Mora and her family were drawn into the group. She was more reluctant to get involved than her husband was, but she was quite reluctant. As the years went by, the group just took over her life.
Wow. Incredible. It's amazing how things happen.
Right. And I won't say too much more about it, but the events that led to Mora getting out of the group really were at the core of what would ultimately lead to it being brought down. There are many steps to it, and it didn't directly lead to it coming down. And it took years and years. I mean, it took 30 years, but it happened. And she was a huge part of that. It's a real credit to her.
The idea that it took 30 years, I wish I could say that that's unusual. And also what's even unusual, if there is something unusual, is that it was brought down at all. Because so many of these groups are not, and they receive way too many protections and can be way too evasive and elusive. And then the people who are harmed don't get justice. And it's very difficult to deal with all of that. And I'm sure it's exhausting too. And sometimes at some point you can just give up the fight.
Totally. It's especially hard, I think, in the US where we have freedom of religion as enshrined in the First Amendment, which of course is like a fantastic foundational thing to what this country is. And I think it's just so central to the idea of freedom here in the US. But as with all things, there is like a dark underbelly to it. And I think the proliferation of these groups is the prime example of that dark underbelly. People in law enforcement are really reluctant to be seen as infringing on religious freedom. Again, I want to give them credit, like for good reason. These are central freedoms and people should be free to practice their faith as they like. And yet at the same time, it means that it took years and years for this group to come down. It isn't actually even completely down. There's a lot of ongoing legal stuff happening right now. Again, I won't give it away, but like this is a live wire. It's part of what makes them proliferate as they do. And of course, as you obviously know and your listeners know, a big part of that is downstream of what happened at Waco in the 1990s, where the authorities really bungled this attempt to deal with the alleged crimes of a certain group. And so because of that, people in law enforcement got really spooked. And it's very understandable. I mean, these people were like raked over the coals in Congress afterwards, and they didn't want that to happen again. And everybody else could just see what had happened to them. Nobody wants that to happen to them. And so as a result, I think there was a real stepping back from being more aggressive with groups. It's funny, like Waco was referenced over and over again in my research about the Aggressive Christianity Missions Training Corps, both on the side of people in the group and law enforcement outside of the group. So within the group, they pointed to Waco as this example of how the federal government just wanted to take down these groups and it was the menace of the devil. It was the worst thing in the world. And like it's proof that the government is not to be trusted and all the sort of worst, most conspiratorial fears about state power are in fact true. On the outside, among law enforcement officials, people would say to the paper over and over again over the years, as questions about this group would come up, they would say, they're free to do whatever they want. That's a freedom of religion, man. Like, do whatever they want. And also, like, we don't want to cause another Waco. And so because of that, the burden of proof, the burden of abuse was higher. I mean, at least in my observation of the events, perhaps some people would disagree, but that's how it looks to me.
So interesting and frustrating. I've been involved from sometimes behind the scenes and sometimes just brought in right after where there's been a raid on a compound to protect children to help people escape. I'm not someone who says that's necessarily a good idea. Sometimes it's going to save lots of people's lives. Okay. But also it can go awry and it has, and it can be very traumatizing. But I also know I have in my head that I've worked with a number of people who said that police would sometimes come and then leave. They were able to be convinced that nothing was wrong. And then the people, the women, the children, everyone felt totally helpless, hopeless, like there's no one out there who cared. So it was still sometimes for some people like the cavalry's here, the superheroes, like they're wearing capes. But it's also true that with Waco, there were people like my colleague, Steve Hassan, they were talking to the ATF saying, don't do that. No, you can't. And they're like, you can't tell us what to do. So it was just this hubris that really, I think, caused so much of the problem.
Completely. Also, just a kind of lack of understanding of the dynamics at play within the Branch Davidians specifically, but maybe more generally with these kind of groups that involve law enforcement. I mean, it's very hard to understand this line of thinking. Like, why would someone put themselves in such obviously abusive situations? But cultivating that kind of empathy, like, I actually think would be quite important for people executing law enforcement actions or raids or things like that. And, you know, I should say, there's a big climactic raid in this book. By and large, I think the way that the officials behaved at that point was really impressive and admirable. They got what they needed and they didn't cause unnecessary damage or trauma or anything like that. I think that the actions in the decades preceding that, which involved different groups of law enforcement, for my money, left a great deal to be desired.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Amazing that one situation in one place is going to impact a situation in another place.
You say that, and that was actually part of what was so interesting to me about this group, ACMTC, was that, of course, they're this isolated, wild group, but they're also very much products of their culture. And I think that that was part of what I really wanted to communicate in this book, is that in a way, they're kind of like this extremist weather vane. I kind of sometimes think of them as the Forrest Gump of religious extremists. They just sort of pop up everywhere. The people who founded the group, they were hippies. They were big in the counterculture. In the 80s, there was this rise of Christian fundamentalism, and the couple really spoke in the same way. The Satanic Panic was this huge set of things that happened in the 80s. The group was really involved in demonic possession and things that were related to the Satanic Panic. Then in the 90s, the group becomes more politically oriented. They become more allied with the far right. And then up to today, where they're huge conspiracy theorists, advocates, and they love Trump. There's a really interesting way of using the group as telling this broader national story. That was, again, part of actually what I think made the story attractive to me, was that there's a way to tell the story of America and to use them as this microcosm for our broader story.
Yeah. Let's talk about America. In 12 words or less.
Oh, goodness. I've got 89,000 words for you about it, but...
Nice. Yeah. Okay, good. Yes, please get that. I'm wondering just about, there's so much happening right now that's alarming, that's illuminating, that's humbling, but also activating for a lot of people with the fights they're getting into, but also the actions that they feel they need to take. It's been a very interesting time. So just thinking about that from what you presented in the book, but also just you as a human being in the world, how is this all impacting you? What do we get to understand about this?
The thing that first popped to mind was that I do think writing this book has given me a kind of vocabulary for some of the extremism happening in our political life right now. There's a kind of framework of understanding that I feel like has been useful to me. It's also just, I mean, this isn't maybe a very nice, encouraging reply. It also makes me just be like, yeah, I mean, people who are embedded in what to me is really extremist ideology, like, again, to my mind, logic and that kind of thing, it doesn't necessarily penetrate. The forces are much bigger here, and that there's a way to justify things that to the outside just seem like unbelievably unjustifiable and unwarranted. Yeah, the way out, I think, to me, appears much more difficult. It's a much more difficult path. And so I think that makes me a little discouraged, I would say. I mean, obviously, I'm discouraged by a lot of things happening politically in America. But I think, yeah, it's just sort of like, how do you pull people out of extremist thinking? I mean, there are many ways, but it's a tough road. It's a tough road to hoe. So I think that's something I think about. How is it affecting me otherwise? The events in this book are quite dark. They're very dark. There are not a lot of jokes in this book. And I mean, who doesn't love a joke? There are a couple. Part of the humor of the book is that the things this cult did, many of them to me were so awful and serious and crazy and criminal. But they also would do these ridiculous things like slashing the air with invisible swords and baking these travel bars that the devil tries to keep them from baking. I mean, there's this weird way where the everyday things of life do have this kind of patina of humor about them sometimes when they're not exactly the opposite. But the story has a lot of really dark stuff in it, and that affected me, sure. I felt the responsibility of getting it right very acutely. It's also an extremely complicated fact pattern, and it was really important to me to get that right. And so why should that affect your life? Well, it affects my life because it's my work, and my work is, it's important to me that it is correct and gets all of it right. And then it has also just given me a little bit of a, you said your next book could be about the choices of pasta. It has made me be like, you know, I think for another book, I want to write something lighter. I think I do want to write something with more jokes than I was able to include in this one. I'm a generalist. I'm obviously deeply fascinated by this stuff. And at the same time, the thing that's really wonderful about being a writer is that you can just follow your curiosity. And where that led me in this case was into this fascinating and wild world. But I kind of always wonder, you know, like, where will it lead me next? And, you know, that's also something that you don't have so much control over. With this story, you know, it's like my brother's, the pipe in his house burst and Sarah walked out. He told me about her. That's why I always say to people in my life, and frankly, I'll say to your audience members, like, if people know a story they think needs telling, I want to hear from you. I mean that genuinely and sincerely. I probably won't write another book about cults, but the world is full of this kind of stuff, full of rich, powerful stories. And that's what I want to do with my professional life.
It's interesting. I think it's really quite incredible. And you might have similar experience. I don't doubt that you do. Sitting down with Sarah Weekly, you got to find out about her life, what she's overcome, envision what she has sort of swimming around in her head. And as a therapist, I think about that, that when I'm passing people on the street, everyone has a story. Everyone has multiple stories. Some they will never share. Some they'll only share to a certain amount of people. Some they'll only share parts of with. But that there's so much that people carry with them from their childhood, from their adulthood, from how their nervous system has been impacted by or has been affected by the things in their life, and literally, like, physiologically what they carry with them during the day. But everyone has something.
Yeah. And it's impossible to even begin to get the sense of the fullness of that. And obviously, like, I've really tried my darndest with this book. And hopefully I've succeeded to some extent, but everyone's a universe. Everyone has depths that even they don't understand themselves. And the other thing I should also mention is that as much as this book is about Sarah's life, about Deborah's life, about Maura's life, and me really trying to dig into their lives in a meaningful, thoughtful way, it's also not a memoir. You know what I mean? I'm a writer. I'm coming at this from an objective outsider perspective, and it's incumbent on me not to be on anyone's side, I guess is what I would say. You have to stand at a little bit of a remove, because I also think that's part of what makes a book or a story credible. If you're only saying nice things about people, it's sort of like, okay, well, what else? Not to say that I'm saying not nice things about these people in the book, far from it. But I think I've tried to embrace the fullness of people, which is to say the good and the bad. And that to the question of, like, we're so much bigger, their stories are so large. The other thing that's at play for me as a writer is that a book is not an act of transcription. It is a creation. It is a work. I mean, for me, I hope this is a work of art. That's what I want to do. I want to make beautiful things that have a contained integrity to them, a kind of artistic integrity. And necessarily, that means you're leaving out so much. You think about, like, a statue. It's like, well, a statue is, there's so much of the stone that was cut away. I mean, a book is much the same. And I wrote so many things that didn't end up into this book because they didn't need to be there artistically. They maybe added something, they helped elucidate a certain part of the story, but it didn't elucidate part of what was necessary for the book. For me, a lot of it is about there are artistic questions that really dictate how I would come at the reporting and framing and writing of it all.
Leave us with some takeaways. You're covering cults, you're covering existential questions. And all of it. And I understand you wanting to go in a different direction when you're writing next something, maybe a little few more jokes, but I'm sure it will still have a lot of depth. That's who you are.
Oh, well, you're very generous. you say a different direction. And I mean, that's obviously what I just said to you. And I think that's true to an extent. But also, like, of course, I'm going to be going the same direction. My life and my interest in my artistic capacity points in, you know, in one direction. And you can't help but be who you are.
I know the feeling. Yes.
Yeah. But you were asking what's next.
Or even just the idea that you're left with just through this process of learning about human beings.
Yeah, that's the question. I'm left with a couple of things. And I think I'm left with so much gratitude. I'm so grateful for the people who spoke with me and like engaged in this project and were open to me writing about them. Obviously, you know, that's a big thing going in, but the years I've spent writing this, it's just become so much more clear to me. That's a huge act of trust and vulnerability. And I'm so grateful because also it's like, again, I just am repeating myself, but like, what a privilege to be brought into the most, some of the most intimate quarters of someone's life. I don't know some of these things about people who are in my more everyday life. It's like the journalistic hat gives you a kind of access that I find like really moving and powerful. And again, a real privilege. I take that away. I also just, you know, if you're with one of these projects for as many years as you are, it just does something to you. The commitment is just sort of a sheer fact of commitment. And commitment, it's like, I don't even know how I could articulate what it has done to me because I think the meaning of it is kind of still unfolding for me. The book, the time we're recording this, it hasn't come out yet. Narrative and words, I've always just been at the center of who I am. And I think it's just been very meaningful to me to have found a story that I think warrants 89,000 words, because not most do. And so I'm just really pleased and grateful to have had the opportunity to like do the thing that I like to do professionally most in the world. I'm left with kind of artistic takeaway. This is about real things. This is about real issues. This is about history. This book is about sociology. It's also a crafted piece of culture and I hope art. I feel like a deep sense of, again, gratitude to the sources, gratitude to my publisher, Scribner, who've been incredible. Gratitude to the people at The Cut who published the piece that led to the book for just giving me that experience. And that's a private thing as much, like no reader really cares about how I'm like grateful I got to write a book. For me, that is a huge thing. You know, I always say it's writing this book has been one of the great journeys of my life. It's been really cool to be on that ride.
That's so cool. Thank you for inviting us on the ride with you. It has been really wonderful to talk to you today and for you to be able to share with the people listening to the podcast your perspectives, because they're going to be interested in every angle that you talk about, because they're former members, they're people who are the loved ones of people who got involved in political movements where they got swept up, people who are in relationships with narcissists, people who just love it, learning about it sociologically. So it kind of hits all the points. So where can people find you and keep track of when your book comes out, all of it?
Please. Yeah, I'd love to be in touch with your listeners. I mean, it's such an interesting group of people, a different kind of diversity of experience of people listening. So yeah, the book is called The Oracle's Daughter, The Rise and Fall of an American Cult. It comes out April 7th in the United States. It comes out April 9th in the United Kingdom. People can buy the book or pre-order the book wherever books are sold. All the places, Amazon, Bookshop, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, all those places. I really do hope people will consider giving it a read. Again, if it's a privilege to be welcomed into sources, it's also a real privilege to be read. And I hope that people will give it a read. Yeah, if they want to find me, I'm on Instagram. The handle is @1HarrisonHill. So that's @1HarrisonHill. My website is harrisonhill.me. But yeah, the book comes out in April. And I hope that it's interesting both for people who've been in groups or not been in these groups or just interested our families and everything like that. My hope is that it has something for everyone because its thematic interests are pretty broad. And I hope interesting. You know, it was certainly interesting enough to me to warrant taking over like 5 years of my life. Yes. And I hope that it has some of that interest for readers.
I'm sure it will. I'm sure it does. And it would be great to have you back.
Please. Oh, goodness. Yeah.
Come back with Sarah. We can all chat together.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to do.
She's a remarkable person. Yeah. I'm sure you would really enjoy meeting her.
Yeah. Really incredible. Thank you very much. Really.
Thank you, Rachel. It was a real pleasure to chat.
one more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Harrison for sharing his work with us. It is such an interesting story to find out about groups that we may or may not have heard of, but that are this undercurrent that we kind of find out about when we just unearth information about groups that we've been living near. They're hiding in plain sight. And so there's a great mystery around some of these groups. And at the same time, there's something not mysterious at all. There's something just about what Harrison talked about, which is the human condition. What is true about us that makes us gravitate towards these sorts of things? Yes, it is true that sometimes we gravitate towards it, not realizing what it is. We think it's as it's been presented. Some Christian group or religious group or some place where you can connect with others to belong, to have a sense of purpose, to develop meaning. But very often, it's not what it ends up being. Like the PR for the group, the brochure as it used to be, gives kind of a glossy view of what life will be like here. But if they really did appropriate and honest PR, people wouldn't get involved in most things like this. If they were to say, oh yeah, well, we're going to be some religious group that's going to care a lot about protecting each other and protecting the world and predicting when things are going to end and being militaristic because we all need to be charged up to do something important, but really, we're just going to be feeding the ego of the leader, and there's going to be rampant abuse and kidnappings and things that are wildly illegal. So still want to get involved? I think there's a reason people don't find out until later on what they're really involved in. And then sometimes they deal with the judgment around that. Well, I've heard about that group, and I heard about the court case, and I heard about the leader. Oh, it all seems so out there. Why would you get involved in something like that? And so time and time again, people will say, I didn't get involved in that. I got involved in what it was presented as. That's the thing I wanted to be a part of, but that's not the thing it actually was. And so that's on the leader for keeping blinders on the people who are following. And also as things progress, not in a positive way, but kind of in a negative way, devolving into something darker, a leader sometimes doesn't even quite know that that's what they're doing. They just feel drawn to taking more risks and feeling like now they're up against the rest of the world and they need to bring everyone into their fight with them, everyone into their army with them. And usually cult leaders do not have internal mechanism to look inward, to assess the changes that they're going through, to be able to say, hey, you guys, I know that you started following me, but something's going wrong with me and I'm getting kind of drunk with my power, or I'm starting to have paranoid thoughts and I need for all of us to be militant, or I'm having this sort of fantasy of kidnapping people or abusing, and it's probably safest for you to move far away from me until I get help. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be a lovely change in this world for people who get involved in certain political movements if the leaders had that level of insight and honesty and the want to protect those who were following them? But here we are with something that is once again militant, and it has in the name that it's aggressive. But some people love the power of that, and they feel they need the power of that in order to protect themselves. What you find time and time again, as I'm sure you've heard me say on this podcast, is that there is nothing as unifying as a common enemy. So many people who want you to feel connected to them or to the organization that they're running and want you to feel like you should never leave it, are going to paint a picture of the world being the enemy, or anyone outside of the group being your particular enemy. And so now you have a chance to band together with these people in this supposed war of sorts that has been completely fabricated, that has been completely sewn out of whole cloth. And what also happens, though, is that then when you have a leader who does start to break the law, who does things where the authorities might get called and a SWAT team might show up or the Department of Children's Services might come knocking at your door, they can say, aha, see, the world does hate us. The world is against us. But no, they weren't there to begin with, just deciding that they were against you. They were there in response to things that you did. But as we know, when you get into the mind of people who are manipulative, when you get into the mind of people who are more narcissistic, they don't start the story at the beginning. It doesn't matter what they did to cause you to react. What matters is how you reacted. So, yeah, they'll abuse people. That's somehow fine. But the fact that the authorities might be called, or that there's a trial because of it, or that people leave because of the abuse. In a manipulator's mind and in a narcissist's mind, that's where the story begins. Because they live their life in a way where they don't look inward and they don't look backward and they don't care about what they did to cause people to be alarmed and to cause people to feel like they need protection or they need to protect others. And so, remember that sometimes there is a way of detecting if you're with someone who is not safe to be with, that if they do something that really is destructive to you or dangerous to you or disrespectful, it could be all across a range in terms of a spectrum from kind of more mild to really severe and dangerous and life-threatening. If the fact that you're bothered by it is the problem, then that's a problem. And it's time for you to protect yourself. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.